Welcome to Literary Hangover. I'm Matt Leck. With me, once again, is Alex Guns.
Hello.
And joining me is Kara.
What's up?
Kara has Kara's been here before, but not on this iteration. She's one of the originators.
That's true.
Kara was on... Actually, I should re-release the Main Street episode. But
I don't see how that's timely anymore.
Yeah, actually, I think it's going to be interesting. It's a little time capsule. Different time, but and Kara was also on the original 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, when was that? That was like,
yeah,
20,
I forgot all about that.
2013, 2012, 2013 probably.
Maybe 2014.
Yeah,
I don't know.
God,
but yeah,
we were really drunk, or I was really drunk.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was too. Yeah, I remember that. But that was a very good dissection of that that book. And but here we're today for another sort of a sexual story. If you watch the Demi Moore version, which I did buy on YouTube, I don't recommend. I didn't finish it. It's not very good. But anyway, Scarlet Letter. I wanted to start with C-SPAN, my favorite. C-SPAN. This is from May 21st, 2001. Simpler times.
and, Summer of the Shark.
This was actually. This was the summer that I went to D.C. As a child to be Meriwether Lewis in a play about Lewis and Clark in the National History Day that actually won Best in State. I got to go onto the court of the Maryland Terrapins and collect that award. So I'm an award-winning actor.
Jeez.
Anyway, this was recorded in Salem, or actually in the House of Seven Gables. Actually, they recorded outside of it. The wind. Noise is actually a problem in the first half hour of it. But this is minute 33. And we have Eliza New from Harvard University, Brenda Wineapple, who wrote the biography that I've cited a number of times, and then the host, I forget her name, and it isn't showing it up here. But anyway, they're taking calls on Nathaniel Hawthorne. There's some sort of, topical politics invade.
San Diego, good morning and welcome.
Yes, good morning to you ladies. I'm calling to ask you about the connection between, at least peripherally, the Scarlet Letter, Puritan mores, and the Lewinsky scandal. And I ask this because it's my perception that a whole lot of people, especially the press, were kind of offended that there weren't more people offended. In general, and it seemed to me a lot of the people that were offended, and we're not talking, were people that took the position, this is none of our business. And it seemed to me, in some sense, that was very much in the line of old Puritan thinking, that to traffic in the scandalous information was as sinful as the act. And I'd like for you, if you'd comment on that for me.
I'm trying to think of how to respond to that. What I was thinking about as you were talking was how no one really cares about other people's personal lives after they've extracted their 20 minutes of delight at a scandal of any kind. And Hawthorne, in The Scarlet Letter, offers us a scene where Arthur Dimmesdale, in a way, goes on TV. It's the middle of the night, but he climbs the scaffold and he says, "It's me, essentially. I am the lover of Hester Prynne." And in that very scene, his mentor is walking actually by the scaffold at this very moment. And Hawthorne shows us how his mentor is much more concerned about the mud through which he's stepping, getting his feet dirty, than he is about Arthur Dimmesdale's personal life. And so I think that even as Hawthorne gives us a community that, because of its social structure and its religious assumptions, feels that the contents of every human being's soul need to be exposed to the light of day for the good of the community as well as the good of the individual, even as he gives us that, he also gives us again and again the way the world goes about its business, not noticing our scandals for too long. And I think the American public, in a way, tired after the scaffold scene, they were more focused on the mud beneath their feet.
So the question I guess I'm interested in is, when you were first like coming up hearing about the Scarlet Letter, because it's in every school, right? Like, I feel like, mm-hmm. did you guys both read it for school?
Yeah. Fairly young, I think, too, like 13, 14, maybe.
And isn't that interesting to read this at like a time where you're also going through like puberty and sex is sort of a new thing? And like so much of the plot is about like, did this book seem sort of like a scandalous book to you guys when you read it growing up?
I think characters having like acknowledging that they have sexual lives was pretty radical, even though I read it much like junior year, possibly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in the school I was in, that to read something about characters that like, yeah, they've had sex before outside of marriage. We were like, this is insane.
Yeah, and that being the thing that like this whole story is about. I don't know. I can barely remember actually reading this, probably because I wasn't super good at actually doing the reading in high school or elementary school. So like I did Brave New World, but I don't know that I necessarily did Scarlet Letter. But I did have this sort of like, there's some sort of, like, I don't know what other book there could be that you would read earlier that has a sex act as sort of like the central plot.
Yeah, I don't think so. It can either be used as like very sex positive or very sex negative, depending on what school you went to. So that's why I think it's so ubiquitous, possibly.
Yeah, and actually we have the first patron question. Thanks to everyone who has become a patron. We're at 87 now.
More than Jesus Christ ever had.
Yeah, Jesus Christ didn't have a single patron. For patrons, I'm soliciting questions. And this is from Pat. I won't say your last name because I didn't ask if I could.
It's Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan. I'm wondering if you guys could discuss how this book is taught in schools. I went to a fairly conservative Catholic high school. And looking back at my American Lit class, this text and others like it were taught with a bit of self-congratulatory tone. I interpreted it as an effort for religious conservatives to reassure themselves that by reading the book, they had in fact learned its lessons, and therefore shouldn't be scrutinized for holding certain attitudes. If you guys have any reflections on reading this in a high school setting, I'd love to hear them. Thanks. The only thing I'd mention right off the bat is elsewhere in this C-SPAN taping, a woman called in who taught it, I think, in the South, and she's like, one thing you have to set up immediately is the different social mores regarding things like divorce and like step families and stuff, because people, the composition of families is completely different. And so like that a huge problem is, a single mother might be a bit like, it might put some kids in a bit of distress, and like, you have to address that, right? Like, I don't think you don't teach it for that reason, but that's actually one of the useful things about this book. And if you don't even go into that, like, you're one, making a kid have a hard time,
yeah,
and also
slightly triggering,
and
possibly.
Also, yeah, and also missing one of the good things about the book. Do you guys have any thoughts about how, like, the conservative thing, like, do you think conservatives could read this and be like self-congratulatory?
I mean, I obviously, well, you know, I'm from Arkansas, very conservative. And I don't remember it being kind of self-congratulatory. I think it was more of a, the word sex was never really used when it was taught. Mm-hmm. It was always relations or consecration. And that's really confusing if you read it, you know, as a 13-year-old, because you're not, at least I wasn't, you know, savvy enough to pick up on kind of what that meant and what that implied. Obviously, I knew that, you know, they had sex and had a baby, but that wasn't the main focus of learning it, as at least as a 13-year-old. My teachers definitely kind of dodged the sex aspect of it and focused more on the sin aspect of it and the, like, as a broader theme.
Like, as like she's rightfully shamed, or can you remember like if that was the sort of tone of it, or how is that?
I mean, I can't remember, but all of my teachers that I had, I read it twice, actually. I had read it when I was 13, and then again, probably in college, and they were both women. And so I think for a female professor, a female teacher, to take that stance is a little strange.
Mm-hmm. I went to my school was pretty conservative, and the town that I grew up in was very conservative, Christian conservative. And there was like an issue with banning certain books from the library, like Catcher in the Rye, because it had like sass or something in it. I don't remember. Like very, very surprising.
If you take an S off, it says ass.
Yeah, that's true. Like you could have some kid like with a Sharpie just wreaking havoc. And I actually, to my undying shame, started my high school career as a young Republican.
Nice.
Because I was really into the idea that we would democratize the Middle East.
Oh my God.
I know there's one photo of me standing next to like a young Republican's like banner with like my like thumbs up.
Oh, it's
being
best.
Like, if I haven't seen it since, but I just know it's out there somewhere.
You need to find that.
I know. That's a
you need to make that your profile picture.
Yeah, exactly. So school was very conservative, but there was little pockets of, I guess, what you'd call like either liberals or like left-leaning thought. And I was like in the history department and the English department. And I would like unabashedly say that like there's like two or three teachers that really helped me winnow my opinions from conservatism to liberalism. And then I remember by the market crash in 2008, which would have been a year out of high school, I was like, yeah, I'm a communist. So reading stuff like The Scarlet Letter and then I have a certain history teacher that were really good at laying it out and me being like, oh yeah, this is not what I want to be or who I am, basically.
Wow, that you said that teacher, huh?
There's like two teachers I can think of that opened up my worldview to something more than what I had previously assumed the world was.
Interesting. Keep an eye on that topic. I want to come back to that when we go through the last Dimmesdale section, but we can move on to a bit to the story. Alex and I have covered a bit of the historical context around Hawthorne and the writing of this, so we're going to focus more on the actual storybook. So we're going to play some longer sections here, and we're going to play them via LibriVox, who I just want to shout out, what's her name here? Corey Samuel, who did she individually read the full book here for LibriVox, and she does a really good job. Now, I did get a comment saying somebody not really liking the quality of the amateur narration, but it's public domain, people. I'm going to use public domain. I mean, I could use non-public domain, and that's I'm going to abuse copyright material.
Well, I would say
that's
up to them. Like, if they want to get more Patreons for you to afford that.
No, at no point am I going to pay for that kind of rights.
Yeah, but if like a lot, like 1,000 people.
Nope. All still right. Not. That would be a waste of your money. because that's fair use. The copyright exists as a supplement to the First Amendment, not the other way around. Anyway, so Corey Samuel did I think a really good reading of this. We're going to go to the we're going to skip past the point. It's very famous where Hawthorne's like, you know, every utopian society has found it necessary to set up a jail and a cemetery as like a haha. I mean, that's why conservatives like it, right? It's that sort of thing. And those sort of sentiments are all around the book.
Through all his work. And, this is like the epitome of that.
Right. And I think there's also a conservative individual versus society thing that, which is, I mean, we've talked about how malleable that sort of thing is, but anyway, so we're going to skip past Hester when she's being publicly shamed, and then she sees Chillingworth, Roger Chillingworth, who sent her to Salem before him, and then on his way got like shipwrecked and then captured by some Native Americans, and while that was happening, he was presumed dead. Hester had the affair with the person. I'm going to save a spoiler for just
nice.
A little bit.
You never do that.
I don't do that, but I'm feeling generous today. So he's presumed dead. So like, I feel like Hester isn't really so in the wrong here. Right? Like, there's some ambiguity. It's not like she just couldn't wait for him to get here from England, right?
Oh, yeah. And it's never... He's not the person that she's sleeping with isn't married.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just some premarital sex.
It's just some premarital sex. Well...
Which they didn't have a problem with.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it was like a consecration of its own. Which,
yeah.
Exactly. Which is one of the hottest section of this book.
Imagine you reading this in school being like, oh my God.
Oof, I need to take the hall pass for a second. okay, so the first section of the book, Chillingworth comes and Hester's held in prison because that you had a baby and yeah. we don't know who the dad is.
Oh man, I would love to be that police officer. Be like, yeah, she's pregnant. Put her in jail.
The second that thing comes out, you're behind bars, young.
They have like little teeny cuffs for the infant as well when it comes out.
And so Roger Chillingworth, who it's interesting. So when they introduce him, he comes. Hester sees him from up on the gallows or whatever, and he. So first it says something catches Hester's attention, but it's not that Native American or Indian, I would say. Red Indian, maybe. I know specifically at some point he says Red Indian, which is an interesting, you know, that phraseology, which I think was more of a 19th century thing. Mm. Maybe not. An Indian in his native garb was standing there, but the red men were not so infrequent visitors to English settlements that one of them would have attracted any notice from Hester Prynne at such time, much less would he have excluded all other objects and ideas from her mind. By the Indian's side, evidently sustaining a companionship with him, stood a white man clad in strange disarray of civilized and savage costume. That's the main theme that Hawthorne always hits with Chillingworth, is he's both, he had this time with the Native Americans and he learned these sort of alchemical arts and their different sort of things, but he also knows the learning of civilization. So this comes up in him confronting Hester about, wait, you have a kid.
Yeah.
That wasn't supposed
be
to
be a terrible first day in town.
Oh, boy.
Hester, said he, I ask not wherefore nor how thou hast fallen into the pit, or say rather thou hast ascended to the pedestal of infamy on which I found thee. The reason is not far to seek. It was my folly and thy weakness. I, a man of thought, the bookworm of great libraries, a man already in decay, having given my best years to feed the hungry dream of knowledge, what had I to do with youth and beauty like thine own? Misshapen from my birth hour, how could I delude myself with the idea that intellectual gifts might veil physical deformity in a young girl's fantasy? Men call me wise. If sages were ever wise in their own behoof, I might have foreseen all this. I might have known that, as I came out of the vast and dismal forest, and entered this settlement of Christian men, the very first object to meet my eyes would be thyself, Hester Prynne, standing up, a statue of ignominy, before the people. Nay, from the moment when we came down the old church steps together, a married pair, I might have beheld the balefire of that scarlet letter blazing at the end of our path. Thou knowest, said Hester, for, depressed as she could not endure this last quiet stab at the token of her shame. Thou knowest that I was frank with thee. I felt no love, nor feigned any. True, replied he, it was my folly. I have said it. But, up to that epoch of my life, I had lived in vain. The world had been so cheerless. My heart was a habitation large enough for many guests, but lonely and chill, and without a household fire. I longed to kindle one. It seemed not so wild a dream, old as I was, and sombre as I was, and misshapen as I was, that the simple bliss which is scattered far and wide, for all mankind to gather up, might yet be mine. And so, Hester, I drew thee into my heart, into its innermost chamber, and sought to warm thee by the warmth which thy presence made there. I have greatly wronged thee, murmured Hester. We have wronged each other, answered he. Mine was the first wrong, when I betrayed thy budding youth into a false and unnatural relation with my decay. Therefore, as a man who has not thought and philosophized in vain, I seek no vengeance, plot no evil against thee. Between thee and me the scale hangs fairly balanced. But, Hester, the man lives who has wronged us both. Who is he? Ask me not, replied Hester Prynne, looking firmly into his face. That thou shalt never know. Never, sayest thou, rejoined he, with a smile of dark and self-relying intelligence. Never know him? Believe me, Hester, there are few things, whether in the outward world, or, to a certain depth, in the invisible sphere of thought, few things hidden from the man who devotes himself earnestly and unreservedly to the solution of a mystery. thou mayest cover up thy secret from the prying multitude. Thou mayest conceal it too from the ministers and magistrates, even as thou didst this day, when they sought to wrench the name out of thy heart and give thee a partner on thy pedestal. But, as for me, I come to the inquest with other senses than they possess. I shall seek this man as I have sought truth in books, as I have sought gold in alchemy. There is a sympathy that will make me conscious of him. I shall see him tremble. I shall feel myself shudder, suddenly and unawares. Sooner or later, he must needs be mine.
Kara, I need to ask you this, because I know how Alex would answer, but in the last 3 years, the phrase cuck, has that crossed your sort of windshield?
Yeah, so it's like cuckolding is the one of the trending, I guess, what, topics? I don't know if topic is the right word, in pornography right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, definitely I've had men even venture to ask me if I'd be into it, which is a little strange. Yeah, so definitely.
But not in the political context.
So, I mean, you know, I'm on, or used to be on, that Serious show, and we would actually talk about it, and some of the producers and the guests on that show had hypothesized that cuckolding is basically, it is symptomatic of what's going on in the political realm. I don't know if that's true.
Do you know what that, what he meant by that?
I mean, I think it's, I think obviously it has to do with ego.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I really personally think it's a power ego grab as well. I mean,
yeah,
I don't really understand it being a woman. I don't know if everyone's like this.
You're also not super online.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, so the cuck as a phrase, I think, has, it's been really sort of used in fever swamps of like the right wing on Twitter and stuff.
Oh yeah, I don't.
So like, but I that. But I think that has driven some of the other cultural awareness of it. But basically, the idea that, and I think it's come up in the right, non, I don't think it's an accident that this sort of concept is reemerging, because I think it really is about men feeling that they have some sort of proprietal relationship with the woman in their life. And we actually are at a time where that's being questioned more than definitely in Hester Prynne's time, right? Like, and actually was being sort of established as, this is how we're going to do definitely do things in this time. And now that stuff is sort of coming unglued. And like, my favorite joke I've ever made on Majority Report that I don't think very many people would have gotten, but it was after a Bloomsday 1 year, and somebody called Sam a Jew cuck, and I said, oh, Ulysses is actually a story about a Jew cuck. And if you had to subtitle this using the sort of alt-right parlance, this story would be called Vengeance of a Cuck. Right, like, he's very upset that somebody else impregnated his wife. And like, does that make him, is that, I guess, does this scene make him seem sympathetic to you guys at all?
I mean, when I first read this, I thought, and actually I guess after I read the whole book, I thought that this was probably the last honorable speech he had made, the last display of honor. Mm. Now I think, fuck this dude. Like, he's gone for, what, 8 years, presumed dead, shows up and is like, yeah, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm really smart and I've got all these things and I just wanted a home and you fucked it up. So this is on you.
Yeah.
And that is so manipulative and just kind of disgusting. Yeah, I forgot your question, but fuck this dude.
Well, the way he talks about that, like, yeah, I put all my time into book learning because I thought it would be, I thought it was the right thing to do. It seems very easily to translate that to like a modern email you might get from like a guy that you had a couple dates with and it just wasn't really working out, and he's like, but I'm so great.
Well, it's like the cat person article.
Yeah. This is a bit cat person-y.
It is. It definitely is. And I think everyone's had to deal with it. But it's, yeah, it's manipulative, and it's kind of classic, like, ego power stroking. A guy makes you think that he's apologizing, or a girl makes you think that she's apologizing, but they're not. They're just kind of throwing you into the muck and the mire of, you know, what you've done to them.
Yeah, I think a book that's focused on truth and reconciliation, it opens with, like, a false reconciliation that you're supposed to be like, oh, this guy is actually, he's okay, keeps it above board, he admits his mistakes, mm-hmm. they're on the same page, and then he's like, now who did this to you?
Yeah, I should say it's important to point out that right before this this conversation, he is administering some sort of draft to Pearl to make her, like, sort of stop, you know, crying or something.
Yeah.
And then also gives it to Hester, and Hester doesn't really trust it, but then it turns out that, oh yes, I'm being a doctor, I'm following the Hippocratic oath here.
Yeah.
And you silly woman, I think he does call her that.
Like, yeah.
But yeah, at the end of it, Hester finally seems like, this, I mean, the way you talk, it sounds good, but it also, the impression I'm getting is you're a maniac.
Yeah, you can see that, like, everything melts away as soon as he doesn't get the information he wants. He goes, oh no, that's okay, I'm psychotic when it comes to finding things out, so I'll get this.
yeah. All right, so now we'll move to I think the first time I reread this, I guess, this is the part that really stood out to me, is it's from the chapter Hester at Her Needle. It's basically Hester has, she's out of prison now. They're gonna
prison for childbirth is such a classic way to start a book.
Exactly. And instead she's going to be sort of moved to the outskirts of town, which this is very Hawthorne, this psychogeography. We've already talked about it, like the way place can have such an impact in the sort of thought and what happens there, or like, there's sort of like a spirit to a place, like the woods versus the edge of town versus this marketplace versus all these different sorts of places.
Like, there can be, in the way there's like a spirit of a person for Hawthorne, there can be like a spirit of the town.
Right.
And you place certain things in certain areas.
And so Hester moves to the outskirts of town, which is, I think, very, like, the very symbolic, right? Like, as one of the women in the second chapter says, like, this usually comes with a death penalty. So it's pretty amazing that she's even allowed this, which is interesting that Hawthorne makes the woman be the most virulent. Hester should be punished more people. But let's play this bit where it talks about Hester going to the outskirts of town here.
Hester Prynne, therefore, did not flee. On the outskirts of the town, within the verge of the peninsula, but not in close vicinity to any other habitation, there was a small thatched cottage. It had been built by an earlier settler, and abandoned because the soil about it was too sterile for cultivation, while its comparative remoteness put it out of the sphere of that social activity which already marked the habits of the emigrants. It stood on the shore, looking across a basin of the sea at the forest-covered hills towards the west. A clump of scrubby trees, such as alone grew on the peninsula, did not so much conceal the cottage from view, as seemed to denote that here was some object which would fain have been, or at least ought to be, concealed. In this little, lonesome dwelling, with some slender means that she possessed, and by the license of the magistrates, who still kept an inquisitorial watch over her, Hester established herself with her infant child. A mystic shadow of suspicion immediately attached itself to the spot. Children, too young to comprehend wherefore this woman should be shut out from the sphere of human charities, would creep nigh enough to behold her plying her needle at the cottage window, or standing in the doorway, or labouring in her little garden, or coming forth along the pathway that led townward, and, discerning the scarlet letter on her breast, would scamper off with a strange, contagious fear. Lonely as was Hester's situation, and without a friend on earth who dared to show himself, she, however, incurred no risk of want. She possessed an art that sufficed, even in a land that afforded comparatively little scope for its exercise, to supply food for her thriving infant and herself. It was the art, then, as now, almost the only one within a woman's grasp, of needlework. She bore on her breast, in the curiously embroidered letter, a specimen of her delicate and imaginative skill, of which the dames of a court might gladly have availed themselves, to add the richer and more spiritual adornment of human ingenuity to their fabrics of silk and gold. Here, indeed, in the sable simplicity that generally characterized the Puritanic modes of dress, there might be an infrequent call for the finer productions of her handiwork. Yet the taste of the age, demanding whatever was elaborate in compositions of this kind, did not fail to extend its influence over our stern progenitors, who had cast behind them so many fashions which it might seem harder to dispense with. Public ceremonies, such as ordinations, the installation of magistrates, and all that could give majesty to the forms in which a new government manifested itself to the people, were, as a matter of policy, marked by a stately and well-conducted ceremonial, and a sombre but yet a studied magnificence. Deep ruffs, painfully wrought bands, and gorgeously embroidered gloves were all deemed necessary to the official state of men assuming the reins of power, and were readily allowed to individuals dignified by rank or wealth, even while sumptuary laws forbade these and similar extravagances.
I wanted to just pause there and go into this sumptuary laws stuff, which actually I was fairly ignorant of until recently. I'd never really heard of a sumptuary law. But basically, for those who don't know, the sumptuary laws are basically we decide who can wear what or have certain types of materials, often types of clothing. And it's basically, especially in England, was used to enforce a class hierarchy. And in Massachusetts, there it was more maybe everybody has to follow these things, but it definitely got loosened on the edges of these are powerful people or you know, they're wealthy. So I have this is from erienow.com. I should look up what this website is before I anyway, it looks legit. erienow.com.
erienow.virus.
It has an article here, Four British Folkways in America. Anyway, it talks about sumptuary laws in Massachusetts. The quote, "The sumptuary laws in Massachusetts also forbade the manufacture and sale of fancy clothing. A statute in 1636 ordered that, quote, no person after 1 month shall make or sell any bone lace or other lace. Neither shall any tailor set any lace upon any garment. The court decreed that no garment shall be made with short sleeves, whereby the nakedness of the arm may be discovered." discovered a naked arm.
Yeah.
Later in the century, or 17th century, the sumptuary laws of Massachusetts became more conscious of rank. In 1651, the general court complained that intolerable excess and bravery hath crept in upon us, and especially amongst people of mean condition, to the dishonor of God, the scandal of our profession, the consumption of estates, and altogether unsuitable to our poverty. The selectmen of every town were ordered to judge whether the dress of men and women exceeded their, quote, ranks and abilities. Costly dress was restricted to those whose estates were worth more than £200, and also to families of magistrates. But subsequent statutes returned to general prohibitions. So that, I don't know, I thought that is pretty fascinating.
I mean, her decision to own this, like, through embroidery, this... Because the A, I guess, is a piece of embroidery, too, now.
Yeah, that she did herself.
So, yeah, right. So, she's taking this, like, token of shame and owning it,
mm-hmm.
which has this, like, liberatory effect for her. Because she's honest about who she is in her place in society.
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, is, like, her as, like, a laborer and an artist in this. And, like, how that becomes what she does is to raise her child. And Hawthorne even points out that that's one of the few professions and sort of pursuits that women can follow that really applies like in a marketplace kind of scenario. And that's actually one thing. If you're a high school student and you're looking for a paper topic, here you go. The marketplace, the place of the marketplace in The Scarlet Letter, like it's in so many chapters. If you control find that thing, there'll be all sorts of different things to look for. And it's this weird thing that I'm noticing. I mean, especially coming from a more socialist perspective, is you see where the market is a sort of liberatory force, right? Like we saw that with Thomas Merton and trade and being a more open society generally. And it constantly throughout The Scarlet Letter is sort of upsets order, right? And the marketplace in the end of the book all the seamen are on shore, the local authorities don't really have any say over them. They're just going to do what they're going to do, and like, you can keep the citizens under order, but the guys that are just there for like a couple hours to drop off some like turpentine or some shit, like they're like looking for fun, basically.
But you could say that in this colonial world of Salem, that's like on the up and up, right? Or it's on the grow, that it's this marketplace mentality that's making people like obfuscate their true identity. And that's what makes Hester Prynne such like a radical character, because she's owning the fact that she's a reject, mm-hmm. and a low life in society. And that's immediately throwing everyone off.
Well, and making a brand out of what they, like, owning that as like, okay, fine, I'm this, like, I'm going to make that mean something different to what you assumed it would have meant.
Because, like, those gallows that, or whatever she's at, what is it? She's at some platform.
Yeah.
That's at the center of town, too.
Yep.
Which is, like, signaling that this is what's keeping this. This public shaming is essentially what's keeping this society intact.
Right.
And she's upending that by saying, I'm part of this system now. Rather than being like, no, don't look at me.
Right. All right, we can go on. We've got a bit more of this clip here.
Plebeian order. In the array of funerals, too, whether for the apparel of the dead body, or to typify, by manifold emblematic devices of sable cloth and snowy lawn, the sorrow of the survivors, there was a frequent and characteristic demand for such labour as Hester Prynne could supply. Baby linen, for babies then wore robes of state, afforded still another possibility of toil and emolument. By degrees, nor very slowly, her handiwork became what would now be termed the fashion. Whether from commiseration for a woman of so miserable a destiny, or from the morbid curiosity that gives a fictitious value even to common or worthless things, or by whatever other intangible circumstance was then, as now, sufficient to bestow, on some persons, what others might seek in vain, or because Hester really filled a gap which must otherwise have remained vacant, it is certain that she had ready and fairly requited employment for as many hours as she saw fit to occupy with her needle. Vanity, it may be, chose to mortify itself by putting on, for ceremonials of pomp and state, the garments that had been wrought by her sinful hands. Her needlework was seen on the ruff of the governor. Military men wore it on their scarves, and the minister on his band. It decked the baby's little cap. It was shut up, to be mildewed and moulder away in the coffins of the dead. But it is not recorded that, in a single instance, her skill was called in to embroider the white veil which was to cover the pure blushes of a bride. The exception indicated the ever-relentless rigour with which society frowned upon her sin.
It also reminds me of how often comes from the periphery, right? Like culture, just generally new forms of art aren't like the main dominant cultural force. Like you have like Jewish people in comedy and, you know, black people in jazz as two basic ones. And she literally goes to the outskirts, sort of the outside of town. And like, I feel like that there, I don't know if that was intentional, but I feel like that there's something there that, I mean, if I was a marketer, for instance, I would use this as.
Well, the outskirts is where you get the best view.
Right.
But that's, I don't remember what episode we were talking about Hawthorne. He was describing himself as a writer, and her setup in the outskirts of town is exactly how he describes himself, like as a writer, as like this job that sucks and you have to like be out and like dig through like the depths of your own soul. And that's why I like, didn't want women to write or whatever his bullshit excuse was.
Right. Scribbling women. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like identifying with her right away as a fellow artist, only she's in needlework.
Right.
Hester sought not to acquire anything beyond a subsistence of the plainest and most ascetic description for herself, and a simple abundance for her child. Her own dress was of the coarsest materials and the most sombre hue, with only that one ornament, the scarlet letter, which it was her doom to wear. The child's attire, on the other hand, was distinguished by a fanciful, or, we might rather say, a fantastic ingenuity, which served indeed to heighten the airy charm that early began to develop itself in the little girl, but which appeared to have also a deeper meaning. We may speak further of it hereafter. Except for that small expenditure in the decoration of her infant, Hester bestowed all her superfluous means in charity on wretches less miserable than herself, and who not unfrequently insulted the hand that fed them. Much of the time, which she might readily have applied to the better efforts of her art, she employed in making coarse garments for the poor. It is probable that there was an idea of penance in this mode of occupation, and that she offered up a real sacrifice of enjoyment in devoting so many hours to such rude handiwork. She had in her nature a rich, voluptuous, oriental characteristic, a taste for the gorgeously beautiful, which, save in the exquisite productions of her needle, found nothing else, in all the possibilities of her life, to exercise itself upon. Women derive a pleasure, incomprehensible to the other sex, from the delicate toil of the needle. To Hester Prynne it might have been a mode of expressing, and therefore soothing, the passion of her life. Like all other joys, she rejected it as sin. This morbid meddling of conscience with an immaterial matter betokened, it is to be feared, no genuine and steadfast penitence, but something doubtful, something that might be deeply wrong beneath.
Carrie, you really like that part.
Mm-hmm. I just love to go home and sit there with my needle and toil away.
Yeah.
I find it very fulfilling.
It's hard to go into your apartment and not step on a...
God, we don't even know what they're called. What are those called? I don't know. Shit. I don't know.
Wait, do you actually do needlework?
No.
Oh, damn.
What is the thing called? The thumb thing that when you do needlework?
A thimble.
Thimble. There you go.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. There we go. Wouldn't be much of a literary hangover if we couldn't come up with thimble. I thought that was an interesting part. I think it says a lot about how people were thinking about women and work in general for 1850. I also didn't mention, you know, we were talking about those sumptuary laws. The Scarlet Letter is set 1642 to 1649. So the details we said were sort of bookending that. Let's move forward, though. Keep a brisk pace if we can. This is to the governor's hall. Now, Governor Bellingham is at the time the governor of Salem, and Hester needs to go to his place because some of the men in the community don't think that she should maybe raise Pearl as an unfit mother. Like she's unfit, obviously, because she didn't do this within a marriage.
And specifically, she's not getting a religious education, Pearl.
Right, and mm-hmm. then that's what they're really concerned about. And I wanted to play this part because it's interesting. The start of this chapter, the Governor's Hall, chapter 7, because even Hawthorne points out, like, yeah, it's kind of weird that like the patriarchs of this community had such a sort of micromanagement approach to dealing with literally everything here.
Hester Prynne went one day to the mansion of Governor Bellingham with a pair of gloves, which he had fringed and embroidered to his order, and which were to be worn on some great occasion of state. For, though the chances of a popular election had caused this former ruler to descend a step or two from the highest rank, he still held an honourable and influential place among the colonial magistracy.
Hints at corruption there. He's getting the fancy stuff that people aren't supposed to have. Give me a couple of those, Hester. You might be able to have your kid.
Yeah.
You put some extra swag
normal
on those,
colony
that ruffled
activity.
Collar, yeah.
And far more important reason than the delivery of a pair of embroidered gloves impelled Hester, at this time, to seek an interview with a personage of so much power and activity in the affairs of the settlement. It had reached her ears that there was a design on the part of some of the leading inhabitants, cherishing the more rigid order of principles in religion and government, to deprive her of her child. On the supposition that Pearl, as already hinted, was of demon origin, these good people not unreasonably argued that a Christian interest in the mother's soul required them to remove such a stumbling block from her path. If the child, on the other hand, were really capable of moral and religious growth, and possessed the elements of ultimate salvation, then, surely, it would enjoy all the fairer prospect of these advantages by being transferred to wiser and better guardianship than Hester Prynne's. Among those who promoted the design, Governor Bellingham was said to be one of the most busy. It may appear singular, and indeed not a little ludicrous, that an affair of this kind, which in later days would have been referred to no higher jurisdiction than that of the selectmen of the town, should then have been a question publicly discussed, and on which statesmen of eminence took sides. At that epoch of pristine simplicity, however, matters of even slighter public interest, and of far less intrinsic weight, than the welfare of Hester and her child was strangely mixed up with deliberations of legislators and acts of state. The period was hardly, if at all, earlier than that of our story, when a dispute concerning the right of property in a pig not only caused a fierce and bitter contest in the legislative body of the colony, but resulted in an important modification of the framework itself of the legislature.
Now, that is true, and I've been doing some research on Bellingham. It's relevant to Bellingham, actually. The pig thing, first of all. The basic thing is, my understanding was Salem had an elected court, and then these assistants that sort of worked as the governor's sort of men, and they often got to make legal decisions too. So this pig escapes. I should maybe just look this up. I definitely need to read this. But the Wikipedia...
Hell of a start, though. Laying out the judicial system and then baiting it with the biggest problem of the time, which is imagine a pig in a cage. Got it. We can all see that. Now imagine a pig free and loose.
Yeah. Okay. In the 1640s, this is from Wikipedia, Richard Bellingham. In the 1640s, constitutional issues concerning the power of the assistants rose. In a case involving an escaped pig, the assistants ruled in favor of a merchant who had allegedly taken a widow's errant animal. She appealed to the general court, which ruled in her favor. The assistants then asserted their right to veto the general court's decision, sparking the controversy. So the assistants, the governor's guys, come in and side with the merchant, which there's your state and business.
Glad they got out of that habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. John Winthrop argued that the assistants, as experienced magistrates, must be able to check the democratic institution of the general court because, quote John Winthrop, who dies in this story, fuck him, quote, a democracy is, amongst most civil nations, accounted the meanest and worst forms of all government. End quote. Bellingham was one of only two assistants. The other was Richard Saltonstall, who opposed the final decision that the assistant's veto should stand. So Bellingham sided with the court. So with the widow. So good Bellingham. Now, Bellingham also, some other facts about him. He participated in the establishment of Boston Commons, another good thing. Mm. He voted to banish Anne Hutchinson. Now, we'll come back to that, Alex. I know you're chomping at the bit for that. He was on the first board of... I'm not sure what I think about that, so I'm not going to say good or bad on that. I have some
banishing
questions.
Anne Hutchinson?
I have some questions about Anne Hutchinson.
I mean, I think we'll probably end up on the same end.
She was a witch.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to phrase it. But he had a sex scandal himself, and I'm just going to... If you guys will indulge me... I'm going to talk about that, too, because it's funny.
This is before the Me Too era, too.
Yeah.
Centuries before.
Actually, I might not be able to find it here, but I think I can just summarize because this is fairly memorable. Yeah, it's not on this page. But basically, he had a male visitor staying with him and also a female. And the male visitor was courting the female. And Bellingham got in there. And he's like, actually, I'll have that. And... And he then wanted to officiate his own marriage, and it became this big headache with Winthrop. Like,
that this rules.
This is why you don't micromanage, because he could have just gone to somebody else and got it officiated, but I don't know, he wanted to officiate himself. So, interesting guy, this Bellingham. Let's hear a little bit more about his house. We might do the Anne Hutchinson thing as a special standalone episode.
Sounds good.
So, yeah, let's do a MTV Cribs Governor Bellingham edition.
God damn it. Timely on both
right?
counts.
Would watch.
Wait, why is it timely?
It's not a good reference. Joke. Not a good person.
It's a good reference.
Oh, it's
MTV
great.
Cribs.
Is that still hun? No,
no, it's
There's
not.
No way.
Because the ruling class the is like shit. We got to stop showing them what they're missing out on because we are losing control this fast.
Great episode is the Yin Yang Twins because they don't know what some of the rooms are.
That's correct.
Check that one out.
I used to love the Yin Yang Twins.
Hey, Caroline.
Stop it!
Oh, here we go.
Elle returned quietly to her mother and looked up, smiling into her face. Without further adventure, they reached the dwelling of Governor Bellingham. This was a large wooden house, built in a fashion of which there are specimens still extant in the streets of our older towns, now moss-grown, crumbling to decay, and melancholy at heart with the many sorrowful or joyful occurrences, remembered or forgotten, that have happened and passed away within their dusky chambers. Then, however, There was the freshness of the passing year on its exterior, and the cheerfulness, gleaming forth from the sunny windows, of a human habitation into which death had never entered. It had, indeed, a very cheery aspect, the walls being overspread with a kind of stucco in which fragments of broken glass were plentifully intermixed, so that when the sunshine fell aslantwise over the front of the edifice, it glittered and sparkled as if diamonds had been flung against it by the double handful.
I'm going to put the Cash Money bling-bling instrumental into this part.
The brilliancy might have befitted Aladdin's palace, rather than a mansion of a grave old Puritan ruler. It was further decorated with strange and seemingly cabalistic figures and diagrams, suitable to the quaint taste of the age, which had been drawn in the stucco when newly laid on, and had now grown hard and durable, for the admiration of aftertimes. Pearl, looking at this bright wonder of a house, began to caper and dance, and imperatively required that the whole breadth of sunshine should be stripped off its front and given her to play with. "No, my little Pearl," said her mother, "thou must gather thine own sunshine. I have none to give thee."
I also want to point out here that Mistress Hibbins, the witch throughout this story, in real life was a witch and was executed for that purpose, I believe, in 1656. Not Bellingham's sister, though. But it's interesting the way that, like, they call it the Kabbalistic and very foreign sort of decoration of the... Like, it reminds me... Maybe, you know, maybe this is evidence that the Illuminati has been going on for a long time. Like, this is just the Nicki or Lady Gaga video of this 1700s.
Sorry,
the Bellingham Mansion. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. I don't remember what it is.
Okay.
They approached the door, which was of an arched form and flanked on each side by a narrow tower or projection of the edifice, in both of which were lattice windows, with wooden shutters to close over them at need. Lifting the iron hammer that hung at the portal, Hester Prynne gave a summons, which was answered by one of the governor's bond servants, a free-born Englishman, but now 7 years a slave. During that...
Hawthorne thought that white servants had it worse off than slaves on plantations.
He was to be the property of his master, and as much a commodity of bargain and sale as an ox or a joint stool. The serf wore the blue coat, which was the customary garb of serving men of that period, and long before, in the old hereditary halls of England. "Is the worshipful Governor Bellingham within?" inquired Hester. "Yea, forsooth," replied the bondservant, staring with wide-open eyes at the scarlet letter, which, being a newcomer in the country, he had never before seen. "Yea, his honourable worship is within, but he hath a godly minister or two with him, and likewise a leech. Ye may not see his worship now."
Leech meaning doctor, which is Chillingworth.
"Nevertheless, I will enter," answered Hester Prynne, and the bondservant, perhaps judging from the decision of her air and the glittering symbol in her bosom, that she was a great lady in the land, offered no opposition.
That misinterpretation of the Scarlet Letter, thinking it means something important, is also something Hawthorne points out the Indians do a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And his, as I mentioned earlier, his portrayal of Native Americans as unable to be literate is very problematic for the time that he was writing in, when, you know, the Trail of Tears after the Cherokee actually tried to assimilate by learning to read wasn't really enough.
So the mother and little Pearl were admitted into the hall of entrance. With many variations, suggested by the nature of his building materials, diversity of climate, and different mode of social life, Governor Bellingham had planned his new habitation after the residences of gentlemen of fair estate in his native land. Here, then, was a wide and reasonably lofty hall, extending through the whole depth of the house, and forming a medium of general communication, more or less directly, with all the other apartments. At one extremity, this spacious room was lighted by the windows of the two towers, which formed a small recess on either side of the portal. At the other end, though partly muffled by a curtain, it was more powerfully illuminated by one of those embowed hall windows which we read of in old books, and which was provided with a deep and cushioned seat. Here, on the cushion, lay a folio tome, probably of the Chronicles of England, or other such substantial literature, even as, in our own days, we scatter gilded volumes on the centre table, to be turned over by the casual guest.
I like that as a little media, you know,
such a fuck
point.
You. It's probably an important book, like the history of England.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. And how we like learn to just revere people like Locke and right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
The furniture of the hall consisted of some ponderous chairs, the backs of which were elaborately carved with wreaths of oaken flowers, and likewise a table in the same taste, the whole being of the Elizabethan age, or perhaps earlier, and heirlooms, transferred hither from the governor's paternal home. On the table, in token that the sentiment of old English hospitality had not been left behind, stood a large pewter tankard, at the bottom of which, had Hester or Pearl peeped into it, they might have seen the frothy remnant of a recent draught of ale. On the wall hung a row of portraits, representing the forefathers of the Bellingham lineage, some with armour on their breasts, and others with stately ruffs and robes of peace. All were characterised by the sternness and severity which old portraits so invariably put on, as if they were the ghosts, rather than the pictures, of departed worthies, and were gazing with harsh and intolerant criticism at the pursuits and enjoyments of living men.
I feel like that's a sense, like, the magic of portraits that we've really lost because of just how media has changed. Like, that the ghost thing, like, that feels like a ghost. I feel like that used to be relatable to, well, at least as a concept to people who were aware of paintings, right? Like, there's something magical about that. Carrie, you like portraiture. That's your art.
The only art that I do like.
Which is weird because the only art I...
The only art that you like.
I don't like art, you guys.
The main art I'm interested in is interiors. Ugh. So, like, Karen, I
what
can never...
What the fuck is going on with both of you? I've never heard...
Well, I don't want to say it's the... Shocked. You're right there. The only... I don't want to say it's the only art I like, but that is what I like to look at.
Okay.
But I don't know. I mean, look.
Like furniture.
Yeah, I want to see how they were living. I like it's MTV Cribs. I want MTV Cribs 19th century.
Yeah.
At about the centre of the oaken panels that lined the hall was suspended a suit of mail, not, like the pictures, an ancestral relic, but of the most modern date, for it had been manufactured by a skilful armourer in London the same year in which Governor Bellingham came over to New England. There was a steel headpiece, a cuirass, a gorget, and greaves, with a pair of gauntlets and a sword hanging beneath, all, and especially the helmet and breastplate, so highly burnished as to glow with white radiance and scatter an illumination everywhere about on the floor. This bright panoply was not meant for mere idle show, but had been worn by the governor on many a solemn muster and training field, and had glittered, moreover, at the head of a regiment in the Pequot War. For, though bred a lawyer, and accustomed to speak of Bacon, Coke, Noy, and Finch as his professional associates, the exigencies of this new country had transformed Governor Bellingham into a soldier, as well as a statesman and ruler.
We'll talk more about the Pequot War in the Hope Leslie episode.
Little Pearl, who was as greatly pleased with the gleaming armour as she had been with the glittering frontispiece of the house, spent some time looking into the polished mirror of the breastplate. "Mother!" cried she. "I see you here. Look, look!" Hester looked, by way of humouring the child, and she saw that, owing to the peculiar effect of this convex mirror, the scarlet letter was represented in exaggerated and gigantic proportions, so as to be greatly the most prominent feature of her appearance. In truth, she seemed absolutely hidden behind it. Pearl pointed upward, also, at a similar picture in the headpiece, smiling at her mother, with the elfish intelligence that was so familiar an expression on her small physiognomy. That look of naughty merriment was likewise reflected in the mirror, with so much breadth and intensity of effect, that it made Hester Prynne feel as if it could not be the image of her own child, but of an imp who was seeking to mould itself into Pearl's shape.
I think that section there is where I'm most impressed with Hawthorne as a metaphorical writer. Because Pearl and to some extent Hester, but especially Pearl, is just amazed by this coat of arms, and you would be, right? Like, I mean, even if you saw one now that was actually fully kitted out with chainmail, it'd be a pretty cool looking thing. And to situate this in, you know, that's how this city was won, really, right? Like those, especially mentioning the Pequot War so soon, and how that power accentuates the symbol that she's forced to wear by the same authorities, right? Like, she looks at it and it makes that A bigger and sort of gives her sort of this... She goes into this panic, you can tell, because she starts describing Pearl as elfish and sort of a the changeling thing, which is a common theme throughout this book. That and it's really smart because it's basically and she looks at Pearl in the reflection too, when she has this elfish sort of glee about her looking at this thing, and it's basically power driving her crazy, right? Like, if you're told that what your child is wrong somehow, any sort of sign that they're demon possessed or that you have some sort of like guilt that you will never be allowed to get over, you're going to interpret that as, you're going to read that as that's what it means, right? Like, it's almost forcing it on her in a certain way.
Yeah. This is like the apogee of Hawthorne's project with symbols and how symbols change, because now he's created a character that's a living symbol, mm-hmm. which is Pearl.
Right.
And Hester Prynne could have gotten away with it were it not for this living symbol. And she obsesses with that because she puts her in red clothes at the beginning as this, like she reminds me of my Scarlet A, basically.
Right.
And can see her shifting like symbols do in all of Hawthorne's stories. How people feel about Pearl is a perfect encapsulation of their worldview, much more than it has anything to do with Pearl.
Right. And it also, like, the story of Salem being the one we all know besides Scarlet Letter being the witch that hunts, which is like them projecting their fears and making them real. So, like, as 20th century readers, we know Pearl isn't actually a changeling, because we... until now, we haven't... it's escaped evidence, right? Like, and just to briefly go off on this, if you look at the end of chapter, a lot of the chapters, and I think, like, if you go from 3 to 10, you can find this. Hawthorne adds them, or ends them, with these sort of supernatural asides, that you can believe the supernaturalism. So, after the scene we listened to earlier between Chillingworth and Hester, Hester asks, "Why dost thou smile at me?" inquired Hester, at the expression of his eyes. "Art thou like the black man that haunts..." And we should make the point about the word black. The 19th century was when black and white were becoming the polar terms. "The black man that haunts the forest round us. Hast thou enticed me into a bond that will prove the ruin of my soul?" "Not thy soul," he answers with a smile. "No, not thine." Yeah, this is a 79, the end of chapter 5. "The vulgar, who in those dreary times were always contributing a grotesque horror to what interested their imaginations, had a story about the Scarlet Letter which we might readily work up into a terrific legend. They averred that the symbol was not mere scarlet cloth tinged in an earthy dye pot, but was red hot with infernal fire, and could be seen glowing all alight whenever Hester Prynne walked abroad in the night time. And we must needs say it seared Hester's bosom so deeply that perhaps there was more truth in the rumor than our modern incredulity may be inclined to admit." So he says, like, credulity is a moving scale and changes over time. But also he does like to end chapters with these little, like, scary, like, tales that, I don't know. I it's one thing I think people should look for if they read the book again. Okay, so basically what's happened is Dimmesdale deteriorates because he can't, he feels guilty. He's unable to, justify living a lie as not coming forward. Well, I guess we have to spoil it now. Dimmesdale is the father of Pearl. Sorry if you didn't pick up on that. But anyway, so his guilt leads him to wander at night onto the scaffold that Hester was originally on at the start of the book. And he sees some people pass, like a churchman passes, and he's looking at, as we heard in the earlier clip with Eliza New, is looking at, like, the mud on his shoes and doesn't notice him up there. Eventually, Hester and Pearl walk by. Dimmesdale invites them up, and he, you know, they talk about some stuff. He sees a sign in the sky. He sees a comet go past, and he sees that as sort of a sign to them because it looks like an A. The rest of the town sees it as a says it marks the death of Winthrop because Winthrop was dying at the time. Anyway, that Hester realizes at that moment from that, from finding him up in the scaffold in the middle of the night, that and she was at Winthrop's place, by the way, too, that she has basically, by letting Chillingworth hunt him, essentially, has destroyed his brain, basically. And so she, a few chapters later, they meet up in the forest, and then they decide to escape together. And they have to choose between going to the New World and going whether on the colonial town on the eastern seaboard or into with the Native Americans, or you can go back to old Europe and you know, start anew there. That's ultimately what they decide.
And she discards her letter at that point too.
She does, and Pearl is not happy with it and doesn't, and throws a fit until she puts it back on. Now Dimmesdale, fresh after agreeing to like elope with Hester, he's walking back, and he has this, I think this is one of the more more psychologically interesting segments of the book, which is why we're going to spend some time on it here. And I want to start playing this now. So he's walking back, and here we go. 4 minutes, 33.
Mr. Dimmesdale's feelings, as he returned from his interview with Hester, lent him unaccustomed physical energy, and hurried him townward at a rapid pace. The pathway among the woods seemed wilder, more uncouth with its rude natural obstacles, and less trodden by the foot of man than he remembered it on his outward journey. But he leaped across the plashy places, thrust himself through the clinging underbrush, climbed the ascent, plunged into the hollow, and overcame, in short, all the difficulties of the track, with an unweariable activity that astonished him. He could not but recall how feebly, and with what frequent pauses for breath, he had toiled over the same ground only 2 days before. As he drew near the town, he took an impression of change from the series of familiar objects that presented themselves. It seemed not yesterday, not one nor two, but many days, or even years ago, since he had quitted them. There, indeed, was each former trace of the street, as he remembered it, and all the peculiarities of the houses, with the due multitude of gable peaks, and a weathercock at every point where his memory suggested one. Not the less, however, came this importunately obtrusive sense of change. The same was true as regarded the acquaintances whom he met, and all the well-known shapes of human life about the little town. They looked neither older nor younger now. The beards of the aged were no whiter, nor could the creeping babe of yesterday walk on his feet today. It was impossible to describe in what respect they differed from the individuals on whom he had so recently bestowed a parting glance. And yet, the minister's deepest sense seemed to inform him of their mutability. A similar impression struck him most remarkably as he passed under the walls of his own church. The edifice had so very strange, and yet so familiar an aspect, that Mr. Dimmesdale's mind vibrated between two ideas, either that he had seen it only in a dream hitherto, or that he was merely dreaming about it now. This phenomenon, in the various shapes which it assumed, indicated no external change, but so sudden and important a change in the spectator of the familiar scene, that the intervening space of a single day had operated on his consciousness like the lapse of years. The minister's own will, and Hester's will, and the fate that grew between them had wrought this transformation. It was the same town as heretofore, but the same minister returned not from the forest. He might have said to the friends who greeted him, "I am not the man for whom you take me. I left him yonder in the forest, withdrawn into a secret dell, by a mossy tree trunk, and near a melancholy brook. Go, seek your minister, and see if his emaciated figure, his thin cheek, his white, heavy, pain-wrinkled brow, be not flung down there like a cast-off garment. His friends, no doubt, would still have insisted with him, "Thou art thyself the man," but the error would have been their own, not his. Before Mr. Dimmesdale reached home, his inner man gave him other evidences of a revolution in the sphere of thought and feeling.
Before we get to those, that's the part I wanted to ask you about, Alex, that you mentioned your change during high school. Did you ever have like a certain day or moment where you felt like you had shed some sort of architecture of thought that you didn't need anymore, and that it was sort of like terrifying and liberating?
That's a good question. I can't.
I'll say about mine. I remember driving home from high school the first day. I did not believe, and really didn't believe, that there was any sort of higher being reading every one of my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what happened at school that day that That's made fair. Me come to that realization. I think I'd been sort of flirting with agnosticism through high school, and then thinking like, wait, I can think whatever up here, and that being actually sort of terrifying, as we'll get to that a bit more. But also, like, driving past the same hill I drove past every day, but it looks a bit different because I am a new thing now. Or even like when we came back from London, mm-hmm. and you saw your hometown for like the first time, it's like, oh, this is still in the same place pretty yeah. much, but I am definitely not.
I don't know. I think this excerpt is kind of one of the things that I find so unrelatable about this book. I think a minority of people have kind of that moment where everything changes and your whole perspective changes. Mm-hmm. I think for most people, it's more of an evolution.
Right.
And so, I mean, I've never experienced a moment where, yeah, something happens or I have a realization and my outlook on life is different. And so I can't really relate to this, and I don't.
Yeah, you're too stubborn for that.
I definitely am. I am. But I think it is natural for everything to be an evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe not necessarily with high school, because that seemed very gradual, like what you're describing. But I do remember a specific feeling of, I had planned on moving to New York like over a year in advance, basically. And in that time, I had really built up what the experience was going to be like in my head.
Mm.
And when I came here, which is just a little under 10 years ago now, I had to go right back to my sister's wedding like 2 weeks later. So it was literally like summer camp come back. And I just remember that fortnight being in New York, being like shaken to my core that not everyone who's here wants to be here.
Mm.
Like, I thought, it's like, I'm gonna get out of Iowa and be like, because no one wants to be here anyways, I'm gonna go somewhere where everyone's here by choice,
right?
And then realizing, it's like, what a stupid thought,
right?
And that you don't belong in New York just because you want to be there. And it's like, well, now, and I've decided to alienate myself from my hometown as well. So then coming back, I was like, oh, now I belong nowhere.
Yeah, coming in with that attitude is like, any New Yorker is like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I hate this fucking place. It's, like, it's literally the same sentiment as a small town, but just much, it's just different problems, but the same feeling.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Okay, let's continue, because I think this is actually hilarious what happens with Dimmesdale on the way back here. And I actually did find it somewhat relatable.
In truth, nothing short of a total change of dynasty and moral code in that interior kingdom was adequate to account for the impulses now communicated to the unfortunate and startled minister. At every step he was incited to do some strange, wild, wicked thing or other, with a sense that it would be at once involuntary and intentional, in spite of himself, yet growing out of a still profounder self than that which opposed the impulse. For instance, he met one of his own deacons. The good old man addressed him with the paternal affection and patriarchal privilege which his venerable age, his upright and holy character, and his station in the church entitled him to use. And, conjoined with this, the deep, almost worshipping respect which the minister's professional and private claims alike demanded.
All these are sort of a sense of vertigo, right? Like, you become aware of the height of sort of how these individuals and the the distance they could fall just at a small action or utterance of yours.
It's like how meaningless all these like cultural signifiers are if you don't put any meaning in them.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, well, I'm no longer bound up in this tradition. So it's like almost nauseating.
Yeah, it's free for all.
Never was there a more beautiful example of how the majesty of age and wisdom may comport with the obeisance and respect enjoined upon it, as from a lower social rank and inferior order of endowment towards a higher. Now, during a conversation of some 2 or 3 moments between the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale and this excellent and hoary-bearded deacon, it was only by the most careful self-control that the former could refrain from uttering certain blasphemous suggestions that rose into his mind respecting the communion supper. He absolutely trembled and turned pale as ashes, lest his tongue should wag itself in utterance of these horrible matters, and plead his own consent for so doing, without his having fairly given it. And, even with this terror in his heart, he could hardly avoid laughing, to imagine how the sanctified old patriarchal deacon would have been petrified by his minister's impiety. Again, another incident of the same nature. Hurrying along the street, the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale encountered the eldest female member of his church, a most pious and exemplary old dame.
It's all superlatives, too, if you'll notice.
Yeah.
Poor, widowed, lonely, and with a heart as full of reminiscences about her dead husband and children, and her dead friends of long ago, as a burial ground is full of storied gravestones. Yet all this, which would else have been such heavy sorrow, was made almost a solemn joy to her devout old soul, by religious consolations and the truths of Scripture, wherewith she had fed herself continually for more than 30 years. And since Mr. Dimmesdale had taken her in charge, the good grandam's chief earthly comfort, which, unless it had likewise been a heavenly comfort, could have been none at all, was to meet her pastor, whether casually or of set purpose, and be refreshed with a word of warm, fragrant, heaven-breathing gospel truth from his beloved lips into her dulled but rapturously attentive ear. But, on this occasion, up to the moment of putting his lips to the old woman's ear, Mr. Dimmesdale, as the great enemy of souls would have it, could recall no text of Scripture, nor aught else, except a brief, pithy, and, as it then appeared to him, unanswerable argument against the immortality of the human soul. The instilment thereof into her mind would probably have caused this aged sister to drop down dead at once, as by the effect of an intensely poisonous infusion. What he really did whisper, the minister could never afterwards recollect. There was, perhaps, a fortunate disorder in his utterance, which failed to impart any distinct idea to the good widow's comprehension, or which Providence interpreted after a method of its own. Assuredly, as the minister looked back, he beheld an expression of divine gratitude and ecstasy that seemed like the shine of the celestial city on her face, so wrinkled and ashy pale. Again, a third instance. After parting from the old church member, he met the youngest sister of them all. It was a maiden newly won, and won by the Reverend Dimmesdale's own sermon on the Sabbath after his vigil, to barter the transitory pleasures of the world for the heavenly hope that was to assume brighter substance as life grew dark around her.
Newly won, does that mean she's a convert to the church, I assume?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would assume so.
Okay.
And which would gild the utter gloom with final glory. She was fair and pure as a lily that had bloomed in paradise. The minister knew well that he was himself enshrined within the stainless sanctity of her heart, which hung its snowy curtains about his image, imparting to religion the warmth of love, and to love a religious purity. Satan, that afternoon, had surely led the poor girl away from her mother's side, and thrown her into the pathway of this sorely tempted, or, shall we not rather say, this lost and desperate man. As she drew nigh, the archfiend whispered him to condense into small compass, and drop into her tender bosom a germ of evil that would be sure to blossom darkly soon and bear black fruit betimes. Such was his sense of power over this virgin soul, trusting him as she did, that the minister felt potent to blight all the field of innocence with but one wicked look, and develop all its opposite with but a word. So, with a mightier struggle than he had yet sustained, he held his Geneva cloak before his face, and hurried onward, making no sign of recognition, and leaving the young sister to digest his rudeness as she might. She ransacked her conscience, which was full of harmless little matters, like her pocket or her workbook, and took herself to task, poor thing, for 1,000 imaginary faults, and went about her household duties with swollen eyelids the next morning. Before the minister had time to celebrate his victory over this last temptation...
You know, he's just And this was prefigured in Young Goodman Brown, this sort of collapse.
This is like the diamond version of that idea.
Right. It reminds me of being a teenager and thinking, like, yeah, a lot of this shit is nonsense. Like,
this is bullshit.
Like that, a lot of it was, you know, I had some good teachers too, but none that were very, none that influenced me politically. But like, what influenced me politically in high school was skipping a lot of school and listening to talk radio, basically.
Sounds about right.
And but the interesting thing about the Dimmesdale is he's contrary to Hester, who lucks out because she's sort of forced to live on the outskirts. He's like kept internal to it, and it drives him basically nuts. Let's not spoil what happens.
That internal suffering that's going on makes him the best preacher in town.
Yes.
Which is...
That's another artistic thing. Like, so Hester's on the outskirts. She makes this great fashion. Dimmesdale has this dark secret.
It creates this greater sense of empathy that he can understand, right, like, even the most destitute person, because he truly does hate himself, that he can't be honest. But that only makes him, like, a more lauded person in society, because, like, oh, he's so humble and he speaks so powerfully. And there's that kernel or that idea that Hawthorne has, that not just, like, the people who've been brought low by society, but the people who are morally, like, in a rut actually have a lot of great insight. If you let them, like, if they're actually valuable parts of society, these people that are what you would consider a degenerate liar, that those people may actually have, like, some of the best insights about humanity and the day-to-day life of being a person.
Right. I wanted to play one final thing from, this is from The Great Courses, just to close us out, Professor Arnold Weinstein of Brown University. He's talking about why Hester and the time that Hawthorne wrote this, and sort of what Hester might mean to different audiences, whether you're conservative or radical, because, you know, 1848, this Scarlet Letter came out in 1850, 1848, as Professor will tell us, as we know, was an interesting time for revolutions.
The Scarlet Letter was her passport into regions where other women dared not tread. And so Hester becomes really understood as an emancipated woman, emancipated into the freest, most modern, threatening, subversive ideas of the 17th century, which is the moment of the rise of science and the challenge to the church. But as I said at the beginning, this book is written at the middle of the 19th century. What does it mean to be a speculating person, freedom of speculation? What do you think people are thinking about in 1850, 1851, when this book is published? One of the things that all people are thinking about is 1848. 1848 is the year of all the failed revolutions in Europe. It is a moment of anarchy and revolution. Socialism is on the rise in Europe, and socialism, which initially enchanted many American writers and intellectuals, has begun to frighten them by 1850. Marx has written the Communist Manifesto. People are worried about the Red Scare. They talk about it like that. We have to wait a full century to get McCarthy in the 1950s. They're experiencing exactly this in 1850. And that's not all. There is revolution everywhere in Europe. Everywhere there is civil war in Europe. France, Germany, Austria, Belgium, many other countries are having civil violence. They're having insurrection. So anarchy is of the moment. But as well, the very first women's rights convention that was ever convened was convened in the United States in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. And believe me, the threat of a strong woman is absolutely of a piece with the threat of communism in 1850. There's a fear that this, and it was immediately written off as part of the Red Plague, the women's movement, that these feminists were a threat to what is our term? Family values, as men saw them. And, of course, that's the way Hester was also red. So what Hawthorne is putting into this figure is a figure of dissent, a figure of really unorthodox beliefs, a figure who can see the strangeness and quaintness of the dominant system of values of her own moment, whether it be the 17th century or of his moment, whether it be the 19th century.
Now, what do you think about the, is she, do you read her as a red? Because I think, yeah, I guess we can get into the culmination of the book just slightly, is when they try to escape to Europe, Chillingworth is there. And it's, you know, the way that Chillingworth is described as being both of the sort of new world and of the old, they really couldn't escape him anywhere, I think is sort of how, like what that shows. And she basically, she goes to Europe for a bit and then she returns as and becomes a member of society. I feel like that is an ambiguous, like that's Hawthorne not coming down on the side politically, which I think is probably smart if you want your works to be memorable, right? Like he's just like, this is a problem with it personified and the people still existed and like carried on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think he does play it both ways, but in a way that's dramatically satisfying, especially compared to his previous works, that Hester Prynne transcends her, the being the lowest caste, like in the lowest caste of the society, by accepting that role so completely that it baffles everyone around her. Because isn't there a moment where she's helped so many people? Because she always says yes to helping people, right? But she's helped so many, and like her needlework has become so good that the town discusses getting rid of the letter, but she's the one that decides to keep it on. So to me, in that moment,
she says they don't have the right to make that decision.
Exactly. The Scarlet Letter has completely metamorphized from a demand from the outside world to mark her to her marking herself as different from everyone else.
To her logo.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that there's obviously like in the Christian tradition, the idea of like the Savior, like submitting himself to the authorities to then transcend it, I think is definitely being echoed there. And it works out brilliantly for like a conservative liberal divide, because it's like you can play into both those sentiments really well with that paradox.
Any final thoughts?
I don't like this book. I just don't. I'm sorry, you guys.
You didn't believe that Dimmesdale seemed like a guy that fucks.
Right. Yeah. That's okay. So that kind of baffles me.
Mm-hmm.
Characteristically, it doesn't seem like he would ever lose self-control in that way. I mean, if he has this revelation of sorts and passes a young maiden in a field and manages not to corrupt her, you know, prior to that revelation, how did this even happen? Like, that's kind of what gets me. And I know that the point of the story is obviously not the backstory.
Right.
But it poses problematic for me as a reader in understanding both characters.
Yeah, I can see that a little bit too. So what we're gonna do then is watch the scene where Demi Moore and what's his name, Gary Oldman, is that that's an actor, right?
Sure.
They roll in the hay.
Did you rent it?
Oh, I bought it under Literary Hangover.
Yeah,
I think
I'll do a little vamping on some research I was doing. So I was looking up Pearl, because it's such a bizarre name.
Right.
And I made the connection between Pearl and the Merchant and the Pearl, which is a parable in the Gospel of Matthew. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "The kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant, a man seeking a goodly pearl, who, when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it." So for Hester Prynne, to be able to raise Pearl and to have Pearl, the daughter, she basically had to give up the entire world. But then in that, she gets like this greater kingdom, which is just one more way that Pearl is just a constant floating symbol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess I have to sign into my Literary Hangover thing. The nice thing about running a sort of show like this is I'm going to be able to expense this purchase. Specifically of the Scarlet Letter.
It's like your own kind of custom house setup.
Yeah, exactly. But I am glad because this is not a good movie. I was hoping to get something out of it, but
I mean, is that the latest? I'm kind of surprised there's not a more like
there should be
more recent edition.
Easy A or whatever with Emma.
Oh right, that's right.
Oh yeah. How close is that?
So I mean, I think the closest thing is that she wears it as like a fashion statement,
right?
And that's kind of, you know, there's the scene where she like throws the double doors to the high school open and kind of parades in, rocking her A.
What's the A stand for in that one?
I think they were just studying the Scarlet Letter in her class, and she like a rumor. I don't know. It's been a while.
But that's definitely right.
Yeah, I don't think it stood for anything. Besides what it is, but we actually did have to watch this 95 version of Scarlet Letter in whatever English class, and we had to get a parental like consent to watch it. I don't remember if my parents gave that consent, but I've definitely seen the film.
Well, you've definitely seen Demi Moore naked then.
Yeah.
All right, we're in. Okay.
Have you typed in your password? I've cracked it.
So, you can kind of guess what's going on here. Well, maybe not quite yet, but I think that'll do it for another edition of the Literary Hangover.
You dropped the
I'm trying to drop the article, but I keep forgetting at the top of the show. But thank you very much, Kara, for joining us this week.
I'm so happy to be here.
Warms my heart. Alex, thanks again.
Oh, yeah.
And we will see you. Oh, thanks, everyone, who became a patron, by the way. Patreon.com/literaryhangover. We will see you in a couple weeks.